Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are digital strategist Winnie Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. And both Margaret and Oliver are out this week, so we have two very fine substitutes. First up, he is a television producer and a dear friend of mine, Mr. Clinton Trucks.
Hey, Guy.
Hey, Clint. Clint, tell everybody a little bit about yourself.
Sure. 6 feet tall, chubby brown.
Clint produces a lot of TV shows. He's worked on, if there's a comedy special you like, he's probably had a finger in it in some way.
Had my fingers lots of places.
Lots of places. And he is in a role-playing game group with me. So we are devoted nerds.
Sure. You've almost had the whole group in.
Soon enough. Middle ditch is too big now. Middle ditch is too big. Finally, she is the host of the Drag Mother podcast to this podcast. You know her. You love her. Ms. Linda Holmes.
Hi, Guy.
Hey, Linda.
I'm so excited.
What brings you into town?
Okay, so I am in town as I was last year when we did this. Once a year, I come out to L.A. and all the TV critics in the Television Critics Association sit around at a hotel while all the networks bring in all their new shows and their sometimes old shows. And there are press conferences and there's parties and it goes on and on. And I'm here for like almost 3 weeks. And I'm like, as we do this, I'm like a week into it.
I'm realizing now that we had pink wine for you last time and
it's true.
Have no pink wine this time.
I didn't want to say anything.
It's a clear mistake.
If you had just noted,
we could have fixed this. But I'll get you drunk before you leave Los Angeles.
Fair enough.
Coming up on this week's show, we're going to be talking about the new Netflix show Stranger Things and role-playing games more generally. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or event have caught our attention this week. Linda Holmes.
Yeah.
What are you all about this week?
Okay, so here's what happened. I was delaying. I was stalling. I said, I don't know what I'm going to say. I don't know what I want to pick. And then the news broke that Channing Tatum is going to play the mermaid in the Splash remake. And I said, I waited for this.
It's so exciting.
And as I was saying on Twitter today, the thing that I love about the arc of Channing Tatum, which bends toward moi, I must say, the thing that I love about the arc of Channing Tatum is not just the fact that he's going to play the mermaid in Splash, although I do want to say that a couple more times. It's that he has such a great kind of like high-low, dumb stuff, smart stuff, silly stuff, serious stuff. If you look at the directors he's worked for just recently, he's worked with Tarantino and
Caesar.
Steven Soderbergh and he did Foxcatcher and all this other stuff. But then he also does like 22 Jump Street. And
yeah.
I mean, he has kind of made for himself an infinite array of possibilities. And as much as I would like it if that kind of array of possibilities were available to more kinds of people and not just like a dude who looks like that, I will say every time he does something that is completely unexpected to me, I think that's cool. Go ahead, that guy.
Let me make 2 points. First one is, have you heard my official theory on Channing Tatum?
I feel like I haven't, which means you've been holding out on
me. It's bold and controversial. He's our Madeline Kahn.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
But the second thing is that I do think, however much it's
God, my mind is so blown.
However easy it is to sort of say like, oh, God, yeah, handsome white guy gets to do this. It would be nice if it were there for more people. I do think that there is something fundamentally transgressive about the fact that it's basically Ginsburg's point that women's liberation is men's liberation, that in placing women and people of color into positions of greater centrality, it's possible for handsome white guy to not have to be the dude, but just be a character within
right.
a space.
And the other thing I think is I have a longstanding theory about people who are very attractive or very magnetic, which is they are always choosing throughout their life between the easy way and the hard way.
Yeah.
And I always admire people who are in some way choosing the hard way. Because if you're Channing Tatum, you don't have to do anything you don't want to do. And what he decided was not just I'm going to go be a serious actor, because very good looking people have done that. But I'm going to be a serious actor, and I'm going to assume that my right to do that is not interrupted by the fact that I'm going to go do Magic Mike. And then I'm going to go do Magic Mike XXL. And I'm going to be a Splash Mermaid. And I'm going to be confident that I can still go back and make a movie with Tarantino or whoever.
I think that it's really because he doesn't take himself seriously, because he allows himself the opportunity to let these roles happen to him. I think if Chris Evans maybe took himself less seriously.
Interesting point.
He'd probably be in the same situation.
The thing is like Chris Evans is like personally super, super fun and super, super chilling and all of that. The difference, I think, is the willingness to have these fights with CAA or whoever reps him. The thing is that CAA is always going to say, like, be a superhero.
Sure.
Cling on to the side of airplanes.
Sure.
That will make the most money, and that will make the most money for us.
Yeah.
But Channing Tatum, deep inside of him, is a desire to be in things where he gets to show off his like, he's too talented. Like, the fact that that guy wants to hoof sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, he wants to be in a movie where he can hoof.
Right.
And that's not going to be.
Dance number in Hail Caesar is
it's so good.
The dance number in any movie. 22 oh. Jump Street.
Still.
Clint, strong takes on Channing Tatum.
Well, I love Channing, not as much as everybody else in the room, but very much.
Yes.
We're setting a high bar.
So, understand that this is no slight to Channing, but he's trying to make his superhero movie. They've been trying to make Gambit with him for quite some time.
Uh-huh. Never going to happen.
I don't think so either, because it's a terrible character.
Exactly.
But it's also him picking an interesting thing as opposed to just, like, Captain America. Not that Captain America wasn't thoroughly great. Clint, what are you all about this week?
Oh, boy. All kinds of stuff. I didn't think it was going to be anything when you first invited me here.
Uh-huh. Then it's anything popular culture.
Then there was an embarrassment of riches the more I thought about it, but yeah. I really spent a good portion of my week playing a video game, so I'd love to tell you about it.
Please tell us.
It's called Oxenfree. It will require no more than 5 hours of your time, which is my strongest recommendation. It is a storytelling game, largely about the relationships of five teenagers on an island as strange things happen. Wow. It's beautifully designed. It's from a company called Night School Studios.
Is this Steam? Is this DLC for one of the...
I believe it's available cross-platform. I played it on Xbox One.
Uh-huh.
And it's great. There's terrific voice acting, and it's largely a episode of Lost with five characters whose backstories sort of unfold in various directions through conversation.
And it's like a five-hour game?
Yep.
How do you feel about this growth in sort of like independently produced, like, smaller games? Games you can get through in 5 to 7 hours?
Oh, as a person with a job, it's far and away my preference. Because if I do play a game, if I get a Skyrim or something, I've lost a year.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Because I can't not do everything. So a game where I feel like I've had a satisfying story told to me in a few hours, that's worth the price of a movie ticket to me, which is about what these games cost. Yeah. So.
Nice. True. What are you all about?
Okay, I saw Bad Moms. I'll just say really quickly, it's good.
Uh-huh.
That's it. It was really good.
It's also doing very well, isn't
it? It's doing very well. And, you know, Katherine Hahn, national treasure. Love her.
Agree.
Mila Kunis should just do literally like one movie a year, and I would love her for the rest of my life.
Okay, let's talk about Katherine Hahn being absolutely everywhere over the course of like 2 years.
Yeah.
Is that good for somebody's career or not good for their career?
She's getting up there. Even though I think she's totally age appropriate and should be able to act anytime she wants at any age. But, you know, being over 40 and being a mom, she's limited to what she's given. But I really think that she has impeccable timing. She can really just fall into characters. And she carried this movie. I know everybody's all about Kristen Bell all the time, but I find her nauseating.
Mm-hmm.
So I really needed a Katherine Hahn to sort of keep the energy up because there was like six women in the movie and only two women really acted their asses off.
Mm-hmm.
Linda, as a deep, deep rom-com aficionado, Kristen Bell, yes or no?
I like her okay. I don't know that I've seen her in a lot of rom-coms that I liked a lot. I like
Forgetting
her in
Sarah Marshall.
Yes. I like, she's funny in that, but she's not really the,
not the girl.
She's not the girl. I loved her in Veronica
Mars. She's the titular girl.
Yes.
Right. Correct. I loved her in Veronica Mars. I think her commercials with her husband are adorable.
Yeah.
I like her a lot. I don't necessarily, and she's in a new show this fall too, on NBC. So.
That's always hard when somebody is a fun personality but doesn't necessarily give you the like vehicles that you're looking
for.
I'm not getting it.
And then also, this is just a shout out to whoever was playing cowbell during President Obama's speech last week at the DNC. Who the fuck are you? I wish you'd show your face. I thought that was the most this is an audio, but I twisted my ankle, so I was kind of confined to my bed for the last week and a half. So I had to watch the RNC and DNC, and it was traumatic. But watching the DNC, I don't know if I was hearing things. I actually took to Twitter to find out if I was the only one hearing cowbell, but I wasn't. There was someone playing a cowbell.
Really?
During the president's speech.
Those people needed to calm down a little bit.
It was a little aggressive, and I know we're not a political show, but I got to tell you, if we're comparing, you know, apples to oranges, the DNC gave me full vaudeville Broadway. I mean, their entertainment is just through the roof compared to RNC.
But let's be fair, that Broadway thing they did where they sang What the World Needs Now Is Love, Sweet Love.
Was one of the most...
That was terrible. It was embarrassing. Michelle Collins, who I love, was in it. I don't understand why. But it was mostly just the passing of the microphone that felt uncomfortable.
Yes!
Audra McDonald was there. Everybody should have stood and watched while Audra McDonald sings it. I want to go back to Linda's point about Splash just for a moment
to say.
Jillian Bell gets to be the female lead of something because a guy as hot and regular as Channing Tatum is willing to put on the fins.
Agreed.
And I think that that is something amazing.
Agreed.
But off of Winter's All About, my All About this week is a pristine white suit that came out to accept the Democratic nomination for president.
Wow.
We're not a political show, but I would say that suit is a piece of cultural iconography. It was a magnificent moment.
Unpack it. I want to hear this.
Okay. So those speeches are entertainment. Those speeches are essentially content that is meant to get us on board with one of the political party's messages or the other. And earlier in the Democratic convention, we had ones that were more entertaining.
Right.
We had Michelle Obama's speech, which made everybody in America cry. You had Biden folksying as hard as he could. That man, you can't throw anything at him that he does not have a folksy aphorism about. There is no situation on this planet that his dad did not tell him a homespun aphorism. And you had all of that, and Tim Kaine was fine. And Hillary comes out, this person who we've told how uninteresting she... Like, after the first 5 years where we told her that she was too interesting and too smart and too all of these things, you know, she finally, like, put her head down and just made policy. But I loved that understanding that she is not as good at giving speeches as everybody else. They surrounded her with Katy Perry and surrounded her with all of these celebrities to sort of say, like, we're on board with her.
Right.
She's cool. And that suit was a way of saying, this is a woman. It's going to have to look different than it has before. But that can also be something that's very, very exciting. And to me, in a very deep way, is reflective of this time around, she has a gay campaign manager who was willing to say, well, what if you were a goddess? Just a little bit, what if you were a goddess? Which is a hard thing for one woman to say to another woman, but when it's coming from a gay guy to a woman, makes a lot of sense. Do you have further questions, or does my point stand?
I'm just looking at you in awe, because it's just the perfect way to punctuate that situation.
It was lovely. And there was also just the interesting dynamic between the Republicans playing a lot of music from dead artists whose successors and interests or very, very old selves said, like, please stop.
Stop doing that.
And then the Democrats just having...
An orchestra. Like, what is it, an ambient audio?
Too many famous musicians for them all to be able to perform.
Right, right.
It was pretty great.
It was awesome.
All right, you are listening to Pop Rocket. We will be right back to talk about Stranger Things and role-playing games after this.
Hey, Max Fun community. This is your friend Elizabeth Gilbert, author of Eat, Pray, Love, and a bunch of other stuff. I am a longtime member, supporter, and devoted follower of Maximum Fun. And now finally, I have my own podcast on the network. It's called Magic Lessons, and it is me coaching people through their creative issues and problems. This season, we have some amazing creators that we're helping through their joys and struggles of making something out of nothing. And then I bring in special guests like Glennon Doyle Melton, Brandon Stanton, Martha Beck, the poet Mark Nepo, Michael Ian Black, Sarah Jones, Gary Sheingart, these amazing friends of mine to come and help coach these people so that they can get their work done. I hope you'll tune into it. It's called Magic Lessons, and it's all about love.
All right, welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Clint Trux.
And Linda Holmes.
And this week, we are talking about a new Netflix show called Stranger Things, which is essentially a horror... Sci-fi
drama,
drama,
soap,
that is a deeply an homage to every movie we saw in the 80s. Linda, give us Stranger Things in a nutshell.
Stranger Things is, as you said, it's kind of a period piece. It's set in 1983, and it basically follows three tracks. One is it kicks off with a young boy who disappears under kind of spooky circumstances. It follows the track of his friends, who are, you know, those maybe 10-year-old boys around that age, and how they go off and try to look for what happened to him. And then the teenagers, which is one of their sister and the brother of the kid who disappeared, kind of team up and they go off and try to figure out what happened. And then the kid's mother, played by Winona Ryder, teams up with the local sheriff, who she pretty quickly realizes there's something very weird going on. The sheriff initially doesn't believe her. There's kind of that dynamic. And then they try to figure out what's going on. So it kind of follows these three stories as everybody kind of tries to figure out where'd the kid go, what's with all these spooky things that are happening. Is it a ghost, a monster? Is it a bad person? Whatever.
So this isn't just set in 1983. It's also trying to give you, both visually and storytelling-wise, 1983.
Mm-hmm.
Is that off-putting to you? Like, as somebody, we're around the same age. We will never say what that age is. but is that off-putting to you, Linda, or is it, like, the deepest kind of satisfying nostalgia?
It was very satisfying for me. The two primary influences that I picked up in Stranger Things are Steven Spielberg and Stephen King. Right?
Yeah.
The Steven Spielberg stuff, it's very E.T. The kids in particular, and I'm far from the first person to note this. There's a lot of, like, these boys running around on bikes trying to figure out what's happening. There are a lot of E.T. elements to that. But the other big influence is Stephen King. And I was a big Stephen King reader, even as kind of a junior high school age kid. Uh-huh. I was one of those junior high kids who got super into Stephen King. And I remember reading It and reading The Stand, those like big brick books, but also reading lots and lots of the short stories, which I always really loved his short stories.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it's really kind of those two things. Now, there's also in the teenager story a lot of kind of John Carpenter horror of the 80s.
The thing about it is, as I watch it, and I'm only three episodes in, but as I watch it, it just feels made out of everything we know from the 80s.
Yeah.
Because there are also strong veins of, like, John Hughes in there with this, like, strictly stratified game of sort of, like, social rank in high school.
You bet.
And also having the accessible nerd younger child, and then, like, the game of older sister having sexuality exposed to her. Like, realizing how much of a trope that was in 1980s movies and how deeply gross it is. That, like women are older sisters that are running around with boobs.
She's just a walking vagina for this guy.
It's just the danger of them being exposed. Clint, why did you fall in love with this TV show?
Well, I'd actually love to talk about the point of the sexuality of the teenagers, because it's sort of the other thing that, if we're going to talk about Stephen King or John Carpenter, the teenager story is really, it's Halloween, it's Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh, 100%.
So more than, like, John Hughes, it's, like, deadly sexuality, because the second you become sexualized, you become game for the monster.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the show really does play with
that.
But
are you telling me that her boyfriend is not just, like, watered down James Spader from Pretty in Pink?
Oh. It's literally to the point where when she is still with him, spoiler alert, still with him at the end, it's like, oh, well, what about Ducky?
Yes, exactly. And then, I mean, one of my big questions here is this show camp? And to the extent that I feel the place that it comes closest is that boy's hair.
Like, that's the only thing that's camp.
That boy's hair is just slightly too much in a way that, like, it's deeply self-parody.
But it's period. Like, that wasn't camp then. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's what hair looked like.
No,
but it looks like Blaine's fucking wig.
I know, but that's what hair looked like on boys movies.
The sense of joy in sort of, like, indulging in that and taking it, ratcheting up just half of a notch more, I do think is very fun.
Between the pilot and episode two, his hair does just go 30% more.
But why did you fall in love with this show?
So this show is all the things we grew up watching. And if you work at all in development or film or television, you always say, like, why isn't there Goonies anymore? Why isn't, like, no one makes these anymore? The children living kind of in those movies in a world without adults, but the danger is adult.
Yeah.
And this does that very, very well.
One of the things that hit me hardest was on the occasions that the children cursed or the older sister cursed, it hit this very 10-year-old thing of when I was watching a movie that had people my age and they openly cursed, it meant that it was a rated R movie that had children in it. And it did sort of remind me of, this is a horror movie, or this is like, this is something that's going to have danger in it and I'm going to feel uncomfortable.
Have you watched E.T. as an adult?
No.
The first few minutes of E.T., much like Stranger Things, it opens with them, unparented children playing Dungeons and Dragons. The mom comes home. She bends over to get something, and one of the unparented children gets behind her and starts to hump her. And the second they say there's an alien, everyone goes and grabs knives and runs out to the backyard. So it's the sort of thing that you wouldn't be allowed to do anymore.
But there was also a time where I think about the idea that a child goes missing. And when I was 3 years old in 1983, and the threat of being snatched was so real and very, very close because of the children that had been snatched. And the idea that a child can go missing in a mall and there is no technology now to really find that child. You can't go to surveillance. You can't track them on a phone. If a child gets snatched and doesn't come home by the end of the night, something's very wrong. And that's what I love about the first episode is that the sheriff is telling her nothing bad ever happens 99% of the time in this town. Mm-hmm. He's probably hanging out or he probably got hurt. We'll go find him. Mm-hmm. And she's like, what about that 1%? And I love that sets the tone for the rest of the series.
Well, I mean, and the cool thing about this show is that it is back in the 80s, those movies were attempts to explore through horror the real problems that we had. But because this has greater distance to it, there is this weird way that you understand that, like, real issues of pedophiles steal children and do things to them, in addition to monsters. Like, there's something neat about living in a world where you have both the reality and the surreality of that heightened stuff.
Yes. Yeah. It's scary as fuck.
Yeah, and I do want to also mention the boys, while they are out looking for their friend, they encounter this girl who is kind of alien to them, clearly has been through a lot and something's wrong with her, and she has kind of buzzed hair and they can't figure out where she came from. And she's played by this actress named Millie Brown. And that character to me is also really interesting because there is some E.T. in that character. Mm-hmm. There's some E.T. and some Firestarter. Yeah. And also, I keep saying this and nobody believes me, also some Legend of Billie Jean.
Oh, which is the Helen Slater movie. Oh, yeah.
Her look to me, there's a look when she kind of appears at a moment when the boys are in trouble and she kind of just is there. And to me, it is so much Helen Slater in Legend of Billie Jean.
Yeah.
And I thought that to me is what that picks up.
Well, there's also a moment when she's first exploring that one kid's house and she looks at his sister and she says, pretty, with that buzzed hair. That is like deeply queer.
Yeah.
And so my question to Winter and Linda is, as girls watching 1980s movies about bands of plucky boys, or maybe bands of plucky boys who had a girl along with them who wouldn't do anything interesting, how did you identify with the band of plucky boys, or were you just tired of it?
I always identified with the bands of plucky boys. I just did, and it's especially since I'm heterosexual. Like I never wanted to just be inside primping and perming and trying to look pretty and preening. I wanted to be out getting into stuff, getting into mischief. So movies that I grew up with that were just like what this show is were far more interesting to me than even like 16, even though I love 16 Candles, that was a little annoying, and I can see through the pretty and pinks in that because I was like, I want to be bad. I want to get out and get into stuff.
Yeah. I think what I wanted and related to in movies about littler kids, like kids this age, is a little bit different from what I probably wanted out of movies about teenagers.
Yeah.
So I think by the time I was a teenager, I was kind of into like John Hughes movies, which I was much more a contemporary of those than Winter. I'm a little older than Winter. Mm-hmm. But I have often said of girls that there's two kinds of girls, the kind that constantly has Band-Aids on her knees and the kind that doesn't.
Yeah.
And I was the kind that did. And so I think I did more relate to the band of plucky boys, but I also undoubtedly would have been happier if there had been a band of plucky girls. And you got that mostly from stuff like Anne of Green Gables and, you know, people.
Eventually now and then.
Sure. And, you know, Ramona Quimby and, you know,
they were like
stuff
rustic.
Like,
when you say Anne of Green Gables.
Right. It's different.
Like Laura Ingalls, like, I was still going out and, like, I was going to get the water out the well and I was going to milk the cow, you know, and maybe, you know, if I
was
lucky. It wasn't in our world.
And I think what's neat about Stranger Things is that it does give you this band of boys who we are forced to like understand as, oh, they are who a TV show or a movie like this is about,
right,
removes one of them and then puts a girl who's visually kind of not a girl, mm-hmm, in there. And I really feel like there is something, as I said, deeply queering about that, yeah, and sort of like,
that's really interesting,
pushing, yeah, it open and saying like, hey, there may be space here for you.
You know what's interesting really quickly on that note is that they make her into a, what is perceived to be a girl. They put a dress
on
her.
They kind of dress her up, yeah.
But then they put like an old serviceman's jacket. And as this show progresses, she's only clean for about 40 minutes of the episode before she's back to being rough and tumble again. That's right. What I like about it. She ends up being just raggedy for the rest of the show.
Clinton Winter now. This TV show is set so much in that 1980s TV movie world of like deep normcore. That it is, every time names are listed, they are these names that kind of don't, everyone's a Nancy or a Barbara and all of that. But it is a world where there are black people, but they exist standing behind Sheriff and only saying, do you really think so? Or as fourth member of band of children, how does it feel to watch something that does not comport with, like, our diversity standards?
Having grown up as the only brown in town.
Yeah.
In a town a lot like Hawkins, about the same size, running around, watched Monster Squad, and we decided to pack weapons and go out at midnight.
Mm-hmm.
Lucas is no fourth banana. Come on.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, he's fair.
The only reasonable and pragmatic one among them. And the show, while it is not about race, doesn't completely ignore it. The first time the bullies come, they come up to Lucas and they give them all their terrible nicknames. They look at him and say, Midnight.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of those weird ways that having the like structures and the reality in the same space are really interesting. Like the fag comments about the kid who did get, yeah, snagged. And then the dynamic of his, some dad then says, was he acting faggy? And it's like, yeah, that's how the world works. Like, that's not how things work in Goonies, but that's how the world works.
Right.
Especially in 83.
Yeah.
I mean, the first time I saw an African-American girl who was kind of a bitch and was in the movie and had a role was Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the theatrical version. That's literally the first time I saw a black girl that was kind of a sassy bitch and part of the clique. There, I didn't grow up having representation of myself ever in
Was that
in
before
film.
Clueless?
Yeah, you know Stacey Dash fan?
Oh, no. No, that was before Clueless.
Yeah, it was before Clueless.
It was before Clueless. That was 92.
I couldn't remember.
Yeah. So, like, I didn't fit into any of these worlds. The only thing that I felt like I could relate to is that I didn't have anything to relate to, but yet I was still exposed to all these movies because these movies were of interest not only to me, but to my parents. It's interesting that you even bring that up because there was no representation, yeah, of me. I was like a classmate in school who walked by the camera.
Yeah, you guys were extras.
Extras.
Linda got to talk but not participate in the plot in any way. That's how the 80s worked.
That's how the 80s worked. We have to have a we got to talk about Barb, too.
Please.
Barb's fucking outfits. are a magnificent.
You've seen the first three episodes. Spoiler. So you've made it through
yes.
Barb's
yes.
unfortunate demise.
Yes.
Well, disappearance.
Did you want to talk about the frills on Barb or the way that she's destroyed?
I think the way that Barb was gone too soon. I think Linda can agree. I think anybody in this damn room can agree.
Yes.
Barb gone too soon.
Yeah. Well, I think as much as I really admire this show throughout,
yeah. Yeah.
and I think I can explain this without spoiling too much, but I think Barb is in the story for kind of functional reasons.
Sure.
She's in the story to bring Nancy, the sister, into the story. And she's in the story later to demonstrate what one of the possible outcomes for Will is. She's there to kind of give you a sense
sure.
of what can happen
yeah.
To people when what has happened to Will happens to them. And so she's there to serve a couple of purposes, and I think that shows a little bit. And
yeah.
I think that's why you don't necessarily get a super satisfying resolution to that story.
But right? it was this, like, a very 1980s way of taking a, like, larger, frumpier girl
sure.
and just making her a functionary of the plot whose job is to act essentially like a maid in a Shakespeare play.
Right.
Just kind of saying, what do you want, pretty girl?
She's Martha Plimpton from Goonies.
100%.
Well, and 100%. But here's a beautiful, like a beautiful thing that I saw today is that Rainbow Rowell, who's a lovely YA author who wrote a book called Eleanor and Park, said that when she saw Barb, she said, Eleanor, because she fits so much her idea of what Eleanor is. And Eleanor got to be kind of the heroine of her own YA novel where she has a boyfriend and everything. So, you know, Barb, if you think of Barb as Eleanor, there are better days ahead for her when she gets out of 1983.
There's also like the whole representation of wearing clothes, that the clothes served more of a function than you were allowed. Like, she had to wear mom jeans.
Yeah.
Because she was a bigger girl. Mm-hmm. And I just remember those years. Mm-hmm. Those were terrible mm-hmm. years.
I mean,
those were awful years.
The committed frumpiness of the Reagan years and the weird relationship that this very, very blonde bikini time was also this everyone must dress like they work in a bank.
Exactly.
Is a thing I don't understand.
That's true.
Clint, 15 years ago, an hour-long TV show's job was to be an open-ended instrument to be able to tell stories 100 times. Now we live in a time where you go into a TV series and it's possible to have a clear arc and a clear exit strategy. The great fear is always that you're going to end up with Lost. But with something like this that is telling us very movie stories, but through something that is like television in that it is hours and hours of TV, do you feel like this is a change for good in television? Do you feel like it is a dangerous change in television?
Oh, no. I don't believe in the infinitely refillable format. Uh-huh. I think then a season becomes how many commercial breaks can we jam in there?
Yeah.
So I do like the idea that there's a story to be told, and when it's over, it either changes mm-hmm. or it ends.
Mm-hmm.
And I think British television has done us all a favor. Access to it is getting us all very used to, and premium television in general, has just made us all used to the idea that, oh, we don't want to see tires spin for 5 years, which we were very used to for decades.
Sometimes I miss it, but it was boring. Winter.
Yes.
I've said that about so many.
So many.
There is a gentle degree. There are varying degrees, but there's a gentle degree of bad acting that occurs with some of the people, particularly...
Winona Ryder?
No, I think Winona Ryder is fucking amazing.
Me too.
But like Mike's mom... He's giving me so much 1980s mediocre actress being a mom, and I can't tell whether this is intentional or not. I also think that the kids are a little bit mechanical and poorly written, but in a way that is very evocative of those TV show or of those movies.
They remind me of the Wonder Years. If the Wonder Years went off into some like other, the reason why we loved Wonder Years is because it felt like, even though this takes place in the 60s and I'm here in the 80s, early 90s, I'm going through the same thing. And I can look back now and look at those kids and understand every single person's motivation, because I've been in every single kid's situation. I felt like they very you look. You are you look if you're looking for like the Dakota Fanning, Chloe Moretz, like eerily too understanding of your acting and how you have to be an actressy, and it's creepy because you're 6 years old.
I think it's great that they're stilted. I think that the fact that they are a little bit stilted is a reminder that these are like archetype figures being
right.
moved around a playing board
right.
and that they aren't sort of like people, which is refreshing if you're somebody who isn't a nice, straight, skinny white boy like who does fit in there. It reminds you that they are representative.
And then Clint wants to talk about Winona Ryder.
Let's talk about Winona Ryder. We need to talk about Winona Ryder.
We kind of need to talk about her.
Oh, well, I think she was given one pitch to work at, and perhaps the story was not doing great service to her abilities.
Uh-huh.
Because she really was only allowed to operate from 7 to 10. She wasn't uh-huh. allowed to ever calm down.
She doesn't have much interaction with... she has very... only until the end does she actually interact with other people.
There's a lot of yelling at light bulbs.
Right. She's the mom like from Poltergeist screaming Carol Ann alone for episodes.
Yeah.
Linda, what do you think of?
Well, I mean, I think she's very good in it. I think she's very good in it within that limitation. I kind of agree with everybody. Like, I think she's really good, but I think it's accurate that she never really calms down. But I think it's important to keep in mind that this show follows only a week or a little more in the lives of these people. So she's got a kid who has disappeared within the last week.
Sure.
So the fact that she's operating at this kind of crazy pitched level to me feels correct. But I do agree that it makes for a character who can't carry the story by herself for too long.
Yeah.
Or you do want that break. And I think that's why you kind of keep going to the teenagers who are a little more, you know, who act a little bit more like they're in a horror movie and they're scared all the time, and the kids who have more of the kind of crazy curiosity thing.
The other thing I wanted to sort of talk about is how you were saying, like, the Nancy's mom is a little too, but I think they were trying to show, like, structure. Like, she doesn't know where her kid is in the morning, and she's asking her other son, where is he? Well, what happened to him? Well, he might be in this hideout. The other mom, like, there's a structure in the household. We sit down and have dinner together. You don't leave the table. The dad, you need to be involved. There was more structure because there was a two-parent household, and it was trying to show how she's doing the best that she can. She's always late for work. She needs extra money from her boss. I feel like they needed to show those things, which seems really weird to show when we all know that that's pretty common for people now.
Well, but it is, I mean, having her have visceral humanity up against Mike's mom, who is like just a series of lines. You know, she is a sketch of a character.
Right.
And I love it, but it is sort of like...
Have you ever seen Nightmare on Elm Street?
No, I don't like horror movies.
Okay, well, in Nightmare on Elm Street, that's basically how Wes Craven gave direction to all the parents in the movies.
Oh.
Is that all the parents were basically like, where are you going? When are you coming back? What are you doing?
They can't be characters.
Well, they all have a backstory because they killed a child murderer, and they know that, and now he's supernaturally coming back and killing everyone. So I think that was a play on that, how the mom with the more quote unquote normal kids is just like, you know, you go to school, you come home, you do your homework, you go to school, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's only occurring to me now that the main character in Nightmare on Elm Street is also named Nancy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I read the producers, the Duffer Brothers, saying at some point that the kids are in a Stephen King book.
Okay.
Oh.
The teenagers are in a John Carpenter movie.
Oh.
And the parents are in a Steven Spielberg movie. Winona Ryder and the sheriff are in a Steven Spielberg movie. That is about kind of discovery. And
they're in Close Encounters.
They're like in Close Encounters. Yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Fascinating.
All right. Let's pivot a little bit and talk a little bit about role-playing games. Clint, why in the 80s, why were pencil and paper RPGs such a lightning rod for parental anxiety?
Boy, I can't exactly guess how it started, but I certainly felt the effects of it living where I'm rural Michigan, where nerd things were precious, hard to get your hands on. So things like a stack of Dungeons and Dragons books, not everyone had them, and you passed them around.
How did you get into it?
There was a hobby shop that sold mostly kites that had one or two books, until I picked up one of those books and made them order more and essentially filled the section by training my friends.
Linda and Winter, did you guys have any experience with pencil and paper role-playing?
I believe I played Dungeons and Dragons very briefly at school. I think there was a teacher who, like, at lunch got up a group of probably, I would guess, socially awkward kids, although I wasn't told that, but my guess is that it was because I didn't have enough friends and they thought maybe this would be a good way, you know, for people to socialize or whatever. I feel like there was a teacher who had, like, a lunch game for a while, but among me and my friends, no.
Any video game RPGs?
Like what?
Like, you know, Final Fantasy or
no.
World of Warcraft or
anything? No.
I got into games too quickly to get into that world. So I feel kind of like I missed out. That's the part of me that wishes I was an actual boy, because I think I would have been really, really good at it. But I was mostly into video games.
But back to the socially awkward thing, it was an interesting thing about watching Stranger Things, to go back to Stranger Things, is this way that these are all cultural pieces from a time when, like, we were telling the story of nerds as marginalized group during the 80s, and then now we live at the time when nerds run things, but still kind of have this marginalized sensibility which they bring out when, you know, yelling about Gamergate or yelling about the Hugo Awards. And I was just, did that disjuncture strike anyone? That we were seeing that story told again of, and this is how nerds get beaten up.
That didn't really bother me at all. What felt honest is how at home they were with each other and in that world together, and how they wouldn't dream of talking about it at school, I'm certain.
Okay, talk to us, what are the pleasures of a pencil and paper RPG? Talk about this beauty.
Sure. So I think when you're their age, they actually were doing sort of the most beautiful portion of it, which is like collective storytelling.
Yeah.
When you first pick up the book, it's pure power fantasy.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, well, I'm not who I want to be, but I can certainly, with a piece of paper, show you exactly who I wish I was at this moment. So, and then doing it with your friends and then sharing that part of them is really, really fun. And you're talking about your teacher is only now reminding me sort of what really galvanized our group. In junior high, the coolest substitute teacher, Doug Hanna, ran our game for a little while. Like, I was like tall and blonde and 6'6" and could dunk. Like, ran a game for a bunch of like 14-year-olds.
The thing of...
It just changed our perception of, oh, we don't have to be as ashamed of this as we were because that guy's getting laid.
I don't understand why Brian Posehn in every game plays a gigantic barbarian who like thumps things, because he's a gigantic guy who could thump things in real life. I don't entirely understand that.
I just started getting introduced to E-Leagues because I'm working on a project with Rick Fox's E-League, and I spent...
So this is fantasy basketball?
No. Oh, lordy.
We're talking about the world of esports now.
Yeah. This is League of Legends. So League of Legends...
Oh, so fighting online.
Yeah. And so he introduced me to his team, and I've been hanging out at their studio a couple hours every week just to hang out with these kids, and I felt exactly at home. It's actually one of the most fun environments. And the last thing they expect is like a 36-year-old black woman to come in there and play games with them. But I feel completely at home because they are doing the things that they were probably would have been attacked for, or would have had to hide in a basement their parents didn't want them doing. These kids are making like $70,000, $80,000 a month.
But, that is fascinating. And it's you always wonder, like, what do parents think when children monetize this thing that they think is weird?
All of their parents apparently are like, it's paying for college. Thanks.
But there is a difference between – that's at least fighting. I feel like there is this way that, like – the way that the kids in Stranger Things are stigmatized for their nerd tastes is interesting to me because things that line up with traditional masculinity more, playing Madden, playing shooters, those are not nerd things that mean you're weird. Those are just like things that a guy likes to do. Like, what is it about role-playing games that is insidious and unmasculine and means that these people are sort of not participating in the patriarchy, right?
There's no immediate payoff. Would you say that, Clint?
Oh, there's nothing immediate about it.
Exactly.
You're building something with somebody. So in the perfect session, you've told a complete story with a bunch of your friends. So it's really difficult for someone from the outside of the experience to empathize with it at all, because you really do need to participate.
Yeah, because it's like fake sports are just like sports, fake shooting are just like shooting. But, like, an RPG is creating a little weird cul-de-sac that your mom can't go into, and so it seems weird.
There's also, from the outside, just the materials they're made to terrify parents. So we were talking a little bit earlier about the satanic panic of the 80s.
Uh-huh.
And one of my cherished things was my stack of role-playing books, and when one of my good friends from my group got sent away to a religious boarding school, he said, "Can I borrow your books? I'm going to teach people to play." And his dad found the books and burned them all.
Oh, no.
Linda, do you at all remember Mazes and Monsters?
I remember. I mean, it rings a vague bell.
It was a TV movie starring Tom Hanks about a group of kids who played fake Dungeons and Dragons.
Right, yeah.
And Tom Hanks goes crazy and can no longer understand that he's not in the game, and it destroys him, and we realize about... the deep danger of, like, committed fantasy.
Supposedly based on a true story, but all total bullshit.
Yeah.
I think that everybody, anytime anything becomes extremely popular with people who are young, I think people who are not young react to, and this is, like, the unhottest of unhot takes, but, like, you know, you feel yourself. I mean, I'm over 40. I'm not going to lie. And you do feel yourself looking at things that teenagers do and thinking, that's weird. And it's weird partly because I feel like for a while it was super important if you were over 30 even to say, I don't get Snapchat. It's so hard.
Yeah.
And I'm not a super duper Snapchat person, but it's not difficult.
No. Like, if you take any cursory interest in it,
take a moment, read something about how to do it. It'll take you 5 minutes. It's not hard. It's not necessarily as intuitive as, you know, some things, but you can't be a one button person. Anyway, my point being, I think there gets to be a point where whatever teenagers are doing, people are weirdly afraid of. And I think that when you add in those elements of like fantasy and creatures and all that stuff, it does implicate people's, I don't know, spiritual or whatever stuff.
Two things. One, there was a movie called Nightmares, which was a bunch of movies together in one with an overlaying movie, you know, what do you call that?
A frame tale.
And Emilio Estevez played this guy who was obsessed with video games and broke into an arcade and then got sucked into the game and then became the villain of the game. I just thought of that when we were talking about that Tom Hanks episode. And then, shit, what did you just say? You just said something.
Snapchat.
Were the 80s, just feel so much more paranoid than any other time that I have lived through.
Oh.
I just feel like the 80s were constantly looking for terror and horror somewhere. What were you thinking of, Winter?
Christine. I watched Christine this weekend.
Christine.
And Christine is a John Carpenter directed film about written by Stephen King. He wrote the source material. And I watched that movie because I knew we were going to talk about Stranger Things. And everything about that movie is about the obsession, love triangles, pulling people apart and trying to bring them together. And then there was also something that I had never noticed before was the evolution of the main character. And he goes through three different evolutions. And usually people, if you're talking about a girl who's going through a transformation where she goes from, she blossoms out of a cocoon into a butterfly, he goes from nerd to, you know, hot guy and then descends into madness. And I don't know, just the watching Christine and seeing those two together combined with how many different elements are in Stranger Things. It was like these guys, the Duffer brothers, they really, really nailed the tone.
Yeah. Stephen King is very, very, very distrustful of popularity in high school.
Yeah, very much.
Very distrustful.
It's so mean. Thank God for Clueless to remind us all that popularity in high school can be beautiful. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back to tell you what our jams are right after this.
Hello! This month's Beef and Dairy Network podcast is an Olympics special recorded here on Ipanema Beach in Rio de Janeiro. We'll be tackling all the big issues. Should athletes be allowed to eat lamb? Should Olympic equestrian riders be able to ride on a cow? All these questions and more answered in this month's Beef and Dairy Network Olympics special. Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Or the sequence where the bullies put the knife to his throat. It feels very The Bullies in Stand By Me.
Yes.
Guy's like, I gotta do a show.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Winter Mitchell,
Clint Trucks,
and Linda Holmes.
And Clint, if you have interesting points to make, make them when we're recording, okay? Don't be interesting while we're on a break. All right. No, Clint, this is your first time on the show. Linda's been here 1,000 times. You may not know this, but every week we ask our panelists a question. Linda, would you like to tell him what that question is?
Oh, yeah. What's your jam?
My jam this week is by a Minneapolis rapper named POS, and it's his new track. It's called Wearing a Bear, and it's exactly what I want from hip-hop right now because I am an old guy who grew up in the 80s. So I like real rappy rap music. I don't want people singing all the time.
Okay.
So this gives me all the rappy rap that I want.
Let's hear it. Some of y'all don't fuck with it. Some of y'all thought racism was over because the president was black. Smack dab in the middle of the smack and dab renaissance. In
the lab trying to change the ambiance. Our ambience, keep the ambulance handy, peep the battle sense.
Why do you love POS?
A lot of reasons. He's had a long career. He's part of a sort of a crew or a hip-hop collective I like very much called Doomtree. But in this instance, he's giving a really simple, it's without crossing bars or doing any superfluous wordplay. It's a no chorus, just doesn't need to overly emphasize a punchline. Just rap clinic he puts on for 2.5 minutes, and you don't need any more than that. It's my jam at this very moment.
Lovely. Winner, what's your jam?
My jam is from Maxwell's new album, which is called Black Summer's Night. And it's called All the Ways Love Can Feel. And damn, I don't even know. Where has he been? Where has he been with this shit? But it's an amazing, amazing four quadrant song.
This is lovely.
I knew you would love it. I thought about it really hard for you.
I don't think Maxwell's ever fallen down. He disappears, but everything he puts out is great.
Everything.
He does a cover of This Woman's Work by Kate Bush that is unbelievable. It's
incredible. I thought that he sang that.
No. It's a great Kate Bush song, too.
Linda, you got yourself a jam?
I do. My jam is related to the fact that I'm out here for press tour because one of the things that we have seen presented was a documentary series that's going to be airing on PBS called Soundbreakers, which is about music production. And it is absolutely amazing. George Martin worked on it before he died. They have interviews with just a ton of really fascinating music producers, and they do stories about it's all about music production. And there's a long segment about Phil Spector. And as a result of that, my jam is actually Darlene Love on David Letterman in 2007,
wow,
singing the Tina Turner Phil Spector arrangement of River Deep Mountain High.
Was this to promote 20 Feet from Stardom? Or
no, this is when she was in Hairspray, actually.
Oh, okay.
So, for this performance on Letterman, they had essentially on the stage an orchestra. They had 7 backup singers. If you want to know how big this is, it's on the Letterman stage, and there's 7 backup singers. All the strings are there. She performs this, and there is a blonde viola player behind her who, if you watch her throughout this, you can find it easily on YouTube, is having the most fun she's ever had playing the viola. and the story of Darlene Love and Phil Spector, of course, is really complicated. She did a bunch of singing for him.
Right.
He was her producer, but also she sang on a bunch of records that she was never credited on. He's a Rebel and a bunch of other stuff. A lot of this is in 20 Feet from Stardom. So her kind of doing the Phil Spector arrangement of that song that he did with Tina Turner, and it's nothing against Tina Turner. You should also listen to the Tina Turner version of it. But there is this incredibly joyful, there's a moment in that performance when it gets bigger and it gets bigger and it gets bigger, and you can feel it. It feels like it can't keep going because the house is going to fall down. And it's so explosive and great, and go watch it. And I've tweeted about it a ton of times, but I brought it as my jam anyway.
And I don't have a jam this week because Linda's is very good, and that will be my jam. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Winter Mitchell and our special guests. Thank you so much for joining us, Clinton Trucks and Linda Holmes. Clint, where can they learn more about what you do, or do you have an upcoming project that you would like them to take a look at?
I don't know exactly when some of the upcoming stuff's coming out.
All right.
I invite you to go to Netflix and watch a movie I put out last year called Call Me Lucky.
And Linda, do you happen to have a podcast of your own people could listen to?
I do. I host the podcast Pop Culture Happy Hour, which is available through NPR. You can find it on your various podcast outlets. You can also follow me on Twitter. I'm at NPR Monkey C.
She does a lot of good work, and we'll let you know about important pop culture that you need to know about.
Thank you, Guy.
Thanks so much for coming here. We post our show notes every week at MaximumFun.org, and you can also find links in the episode descriptions of the podcast. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to M. Keener and UJWR for the 5-star reviews in iTunes. That is not enough reviews in iTunes. Just 2 in a week. Normally, we would threaten the life of Margaret Wapner.
But we're going to just send your ass to the upside down.
Well, no, I was going to say that we would kill Clint. If you guys don't give us
a
reasonable number of
reviews in the next week, we will kill Clint in trucks. If you've got an opinion you want to share about this week's topics, you can join the
conversation. Mama's Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Shh. Be a good host, Winter.
I'm sorry.
If you've got an opinion you want to share about this week's topics, you can join in the conversation on our Facebook group or tweet us. We're at Pop Rocket. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producers are Colin Anderson and the very safe Christian Duenas.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.